Tuesdays were market days. Not just for me, but for the entire city, the Riff women parading down from the mountains heralding the start, their baskets and carts overflowing with fruits and vegetables, their donkeys flanking them on either side. In response, Tangier came alive. Crowds emerged, the streets flooding with men and women, foreigners and locals alike, pointing and ordering, arguing and bartering, exchanging coin for a bit of this, a bit of that. The sun seemed somehow brighter on these days, hotter, the scorch of it burning the nape of my neck. Standing at the window now, looking down upon the swelling crowds, I made the silent wish that it was still Monday. But then, Monday, I knew, was always a false hope, a false comfort, before Tuesday would eventually come again, and I would be forced to stand in the chaos swirling below me, forced to stand before the impressive Riff women, adorned in their bright colours that caught and fought for attention, their eyes evaluating my own drab, ordinary dress that could not measure up, and seized with a sense of worry, worry that I would pay an exorbitant price without realising it, that I would give the wrong coin, that I would say the wrong words, that I would make a fool of myself and they would all laugh, and it would be evident what a mistake I had made in coming here. Morocco. The name conjured up images of a vast desert nothingness, of a piercing red sun. The first time I had heard John mention it, I had sputtered and coughed on the drink he had pushed into my hand. We had met at the Ritz in Piccadilly, and only at Aunt Maud's insistence, which I could feel in those weeks after I returned from Bennington College, pushing, a headache that I could never quite manage to escape. I had been back in England for only a few months, had known John for less than that, but in that moment I was certain I could feel it, his excitement, his energy filling the space around us, pumping through the warm summer air. Leaning in, eager to grasp it, to hold it, to claim some of it for my own, I had let the idea settle between us. Africa. Morocco. A few weeks earlier I would have balked, perhaps a week later I would have only laughed. But on that particular day, in that particular moment, listening to John's words, to his promises, his dreams, they had felt all too real, all too attainable. For the first time since Vermont I found myself wanting. I didn't know what exactly, and I suspected in that moment that it might not even be the man sitting before me, but wanting something all the same. I had taken a sip of the cocktail he had ordered for me, the champagne already warm and flat, feeling the acid on my tongue, in my belly. I had reached over, before I could change my mind, clasping his hand between my fingers. For although John McAllister was certainly not what I had once dreamed of for myself, he was loud and gregarious, brash and oftentimes reckless, I had found myself reveling in the opportunity that he had presented to forget, to leave the past behind, to not think each and every second of the day about what had happened in the cold, wintry green mountains of Vermont. Over a year now, and it was still cast in a hazy fog that I could not seem to work my way out of, no matter how long I tripped through the labyrinth. "It's better that way," my aunt had said afterward, when I had told her about the vaporous sheen my memories had taken on, how I could no longer remember the details of that horrible night, of the days that followed. "Leave it in the past," she had urged, as if my memories were objects that could be packed away, in boxes secure enough to ensure they would never let loose the secrets held within. And I had, in a way, had shut my eyes to the past, had opened them to John, to Tangier, to the blazing sun of Morocco, to the adventure that he had promised, with a proposal and a proper ring, though not an actual ceremony, just a signed slip of paper. "But we can't," I had protested at first. "We hardly know one another."
"But of course we do," he had assured me. "Why, your family is practically related to my family. If anything, we know one another too well."
He laughed, flashing me that wicked grin. There would be no name change, I was adamant on that point. It felt important, somehow, to retain some part of myself, my family, after everything that had happened. And there was something else, too, something I had a harder time explaining, even to myself. For although my aunt's guardianship would technically dissolve upon my marriage, she would still retain control of my financial trust until I turned the age of 21, at which time my parents' estate would at last be released into my own name. The idea of being doubly covered seemed entirely too daunting. And so, when I reached for my passport, it was still Alice Shipley written there.